technicians and machinery in restricted areas, and in the non-restricted areas, their numerous guests go about their business. But the cams at the main gate show something else entirely, something that hits Pete like 1,000 volts. There are dozens of people at the gate, all amassed at the entrance. At first, he thinks it's some sort of protest or strange demonstration. There have been plenty of those in this drought climate. But why here? And then, he realizes the object of their attention. It's the incoming water truck, and it's totally encircled. This isn't just a protest. It's something far more dangerous, more desperate. "How many guards do we have on duty?" Pete asks the control room supervisor. 3, he answers, including the one at the gate. "Get them all down there." "Should I call this into the home office?" "Are you kidding me? Call 911. And then on the screen, the crowd seems to explode into action. All of them, all at once. They're ripping bottles off the truck, smashing the windshield, pulling out the driver. My God, it happened in the blink of an eye. From the passenger seat emerges what looks like a security guard. "Is that a shotgun?" The man raises it, silently fires it into the air, and a second later, Pete hears the delayed report of the gunshot, dull and distant. But the man who fired the gun gets off no more than a warning shot, because the mob rips the shotgun from him and pulls him down into a melee of angry hands. The supervisor dispatches the other guards and begins to frantically call 911, but it's too late, because that mob in its righteous rage is crashing through the gate and flooding into Pete's plant. And it's more than just dozens of people. It could be hundreds. Helpless, plant manager Pete Flores watches the security screen and realizes that, like electricity itself, this mob is a force as dangerous as that Japanese tsunami. And it may be his turn to go down with the ship. 7. Kelton.
As the hours pass, I start to get the feeling that Mom isn't very happy with the way Dad handled the confrontation with Maleki, because tonight, she's making dinner an hour early, a nervous habit she's developed when things get tense at our house. Early dinner means she can get to bed early and end an undesirable day. My mom is also a compulsive freezer, and because we're trying to conserve the food we have, we somehow end up with defrosted honey-baked ham from Easter and half a green bean casserole that may have been from last Christmas, but don't quote me. Mom fills all of our glasses with water. It's more than we're supposed to have, considering our rations, but it's not just that. She's filled our glasses to the brim, so that you can't lift them without spilling some. Another sign that she's angry at my father. Dad takes his seat at his spot at the head of the table, for the moment oblivious to Mom's irritated overtures, and begins making incisions in his ham. The sound of scraping cutlery. The ticking clock. No one's talking. The tension so thick in the air you'd need a machete just to make it to the refrigerator and back. Finally, my father notices it. He looks at my mom, looks at me, then continues cutting. I try to lighten the mood with something positive. "Is Brady coming?" I ask anyone who'll answer. Dad responds, "We still can't get a hold of him." So much for lightening things. I realize that Brady's lack of response is yet another trigger point of stress. Brady's never been good with phones, or emails, or any sort of communication at all. These days, he only gets in touch when he feels like it, and only responds when he has to. I thought with the tap out that might change, but apparently not. "We're going to wait for him, right?" I ask. "I mean, before we leave for the bug out?" Dad chews intensely.
"We shouldn't stay here much longer," he says. "You can see how things are already breaking down."
Mom refills my half-drunk glass back to the absolute brim.
"Mary Beth, this water is supposed to last us," he finally says, pointing with his fork.
"Your son is thirsty."
Though I'm not, really. "Good. Being a little bit thirsty will remind us why we need to ration," he rebuts, his anger beginning to fill to the brim.
"We have plenty," Mom reminds him. "And if we're not going to share it, we might as well drink it all ourselves, until we burst." Since I was a child, I always knew when my parents were having crypto arguments in front of me because they start overemphasizing words.
"We've shared every day," my dad says. "I taught the Clarks how to make a portable greenhouse, and even gave them some of the materials. I showed your friends down the block how to set up an outhouse."
Mom gets up and throws away her paper dinner plate, even though she's barely touched her meal.
"Well, I don't see the harm in sharing a few necessities like water if we're going to be leaving it behind anyway once we leave for the bug out."
My dad takes a deep breath, which signals a lecture.
"You know how it works, Mary Beth. If we start giving away free water, people are going to start demanding we give more. And when things get violent, they'll just take. And as you can clearly see," he motions in the direction of the Malecki's house, "even sharing information is dangerous past this point."
"They are our neighbors."
"When it comes down to survival, you don't have neighbors."
"We're going to have to live with these people when this is all over."
"Live is the key word here. If this is as bad as I think it is, not everyone is going to make it. And if we're going to remain among the living, we need to stick with our survival plan and keep a tight lid on our supplies. You want to give things away? Fine. Leave the door wide open when we leave for the bug out and let the marauders strip this place down to the wall studs."
Mom breaks. Dad pushed just the right button. The one in between the commands for yell and cry. The same one he always pushes. The power button. Mom totally shuts down, clamming up and falling silent. Chances are she'll be like this all night, and maybe even tomorrow. I take up her defense, though speaking in a way my father can understand. "As herders, we're supposed to be a source of guidance, but we're doing nothing to help the sheep," I say.
"Before we can help anyone else, we need to make sure we're secure."
"And when will that be?"
"I'll tell you."
And with that, he folds his napkin, guzzles his water in audible gulps until the glass is empty, then exits the kitchen, leaving me alone with my crashed mom and the bizarro holiday dinner from hell. Fights like the one my parents had at dinner have been a regular occurrence at my house for as long as I can remember. It's one of the reasons why Brady left after he graduated from high school. Plus, the fact that he got into Stanford and refused to go. That alone set him up as an enemy of the people in our father's eyes. For the few months before his graduation, Dad would not leave him alone about it. "Do you realize the opportunity you're getting?" my father would say. "You're throwing your life away for some girl." Because that's why Brady said he wasn't going. His girlfriend was going to Saddleback, our local community college, and he wanted to be where she was. That wasn't the real reason, though. I know Brady better than my parents do. The real reason he didn't go to Stanford was because he was scared. I'm not exactly sure what he was scared of. Being on his own, not measuring up, living with strangers, maybe a combination of all of those things. Anyway, he moved out, got a job at GameStop, and now he only comes home for holidays. He stopped coming with his girlfriend, which means either she can't stand our family, or he broke up with her. Brady hasn't said either way. My dad might not see eye to eye with him, but I know how much he still loves him. Because even though we're constantly rekeying our doors, Dad always leaves a key hidden in the yard for Brady, just in case he comes home. He's the one person in the universe allowed to bypass all of our security. The day of the tap-out, I texted Brady and called him, just as my parents had, leaving a message that he needs to come with us to the bug out. But like I said, he's not the most responsive person. Our primary form of communication now is online RPG games. He's a knight, a mercenary, or an assassin, depending on the game. I'm always his sidekick. I've been getting online hoping to catch him playing, but so far, nothing. Today's parental dispute has left Mom sitting on the couch, blank-faced, hopped up on Xanax, and watching the news while defiantly downing a full gallon of water. My dad has retreated into the garage again, welding and sawing with full tilt intensity. So I take it they haven't quite made up yet. "You okay?" I ask Mom. "I'm fine, Kelton," she says. "Just tired." And I know her definition of tired can fill volumes. I'm guessing that my father is working on one of the booby traps we planned out a couple of Saturdays back, which I'm sure will turn out awesome. My dad always makes the best weapons when he's angry. Nevertheless, this is my cue to get out of the house. I decide to go check in on Alyssa. I find Alyssa and Garrett on their back patio. It's toward the end of twilight now, and they're wrestling with a black plastic trash bag, a bucket, and their barbecue. Seems as if they're working on a condensation trap to purify some water, and though I'm thoroughly impressed that they even know what a condensation trap is, they're going about it all wrong. "Hey," I say coolly.
"Hey," Alyssa responds from behind the trash bag.
"Don't you think it would be best to do that during the day, seeing as the sun is nearly down?
Evaporation and all."
Alyssa throws the bag in frustration. "We started this during the day," she snaps. "Day or night, it doesn't matter, because it's not working." She leans up against the wall of their house and goes to take a sip from a water bottle that's down to the dregs.
"Save what you got and have some of mine."
I extend my canteen graciously. Alyssa takes it without hesitation and drinks.
"How much are you going to charge for that sip?" she asks.
$10?
$20?
I just smile.
"Don't worry about it. I've got a 35-gallon tank, remember?"
She hands my canteen back to me.
"I'm sorry," she says. "I'm just on edge. Our parents went down to the beach and they're not back yet."
"It's been 6.5 hours,
adds Garrett, taking his cue to worry from Alyssa. I realize it's my job to be the optimist here, which isn't a role I'm used to, but in difficult times, you gotta be flexible.
"I'm sure they're fine," I tell her. "The lines must be massive, and getting back might take a lot longer than going."
"They're not answering their cell phones," Garrett says.
"I told you, their phones are probably dead," she tells her brother.
"Mom's phone never holds a charge long, and you know how Dad's always forgetting to charge his."
"Also," I suggest, "it could be a system overload. Cellular frequencies get jammed in densely populated situations."
"Like at a concert," Alyssa says, unable to hold back a wave of relief.
"Exactly."
"Then right now, we'll just have to sit tight and hope for the best," Alyssa affirms for herself.
I'm glad I can at least inspire the idea of hope. Their dog, Kingston, who's looking sluggish, comes up to Alyssa and nudges her with his nose. His nose is way drier than a dog's ought to be. I pour some water out on the patio for him to lap up, which he does.
"Hey, I've been thinking about it, and I figured out a new way for you to get water."
I say it mysteriously, like a magician presenting his next act.
"How?"
Garrett asks.
"I'll show you."
Then, I usher them into their house and stop in the kitchen.
"The freezer. Have you scraped the ice from the walls?"
"Try that the first day," Alyssa responds, folding her arms. "It's a frost-free refrigerator. No ice." I open the freezer slightly.
"It's only frost-free if you leave it closed. If you leave it ajar, water will eventually condense and freeze against the walls. Then you can scrape it off and melt it."
"Hey, that's pretty smart," Garrett says earnestly.
I lean nonchalantly against the refrigerator, accidentally closing the freezer all the way again.
"I am ranked 2nd in our junior class."
"Not first," Garrett teases.
It's Alyssa who smiles at that.
"Don't tell me," she says. "Zeke Srinivasar Smith."
I sigh at the mention of my nemesis.
Zeke Srinivasar Smith.
An exchange student from God knows where who's probably a genetic mutation. It seems as if we might be on the verge of bonding because she seems ready to tell her own Zeke story because everyone in school has one Zeke story or another, but her attention is grabbed by something on the living room TV, a news report. There's footage of raging brush fires and riot police in downtown Los Angeles, and the news anchor, only one instead of the usual two, says, "As a precaution, residents are instructed to stay in their homes and remain calm." But in direct opposition to the anchorman's attempt to soothe viewers, the crawl below reads, "Southland declared official FEMA disaster zone." Then, the TV suddenly goes off. It's Garrett. He's turned it off. He keeps the remote out of reach just in case his sister or I want to turn the TV back on.
"I don't want to watch that. They're just trying to freak us out."
"They're saying we should stay calm," Alyssa points out.
Yeah, that's what they said to people on the Titanic when they already knew it was going down.
And he's right. As far as authority is concerned, calm people quietly dying is a lot easier to deal with than angry people fighting for their lives. We all stand there in uneasy silence until Alyssa gets down on a knee to Garrett.
It's going to be okay, she says,
not as sure about it as she's trying to sound.
It's too dark to do anything now. If Mom and Dad aren't back by sunrise, I'll go find them.
And after hearing those words, seeing the look on her face, something suddenly takes me over. This strange innate force. Kind of like the feeling I had when I shot Mr. Malecki in the chest to save him. A sense of knowing what to do, and doing it, regardless of the consequences. We'll go together, I tell her. And I'll stay here tonight, so you don't have to worry about this alone. Alyssa shakes her head, smirking.
Thanks, but... No. I'm sure you need to do this for some sort of merit badge, but I'm not a damsel in distress.
I find myself getting angry. Is that what she thinks this is about? Last week, maybe, but today, it's the furthest thing from my mind. Look, I tell her in complete honesty, I know I'm not your first choice for a friend, but remember, there's safety in numbers. There are a lot of thirsty people out there, and things can get sketchy pretty quick. If I stay, we can take turns keeping watch, and you can get some sleep.
Do you really think we're going to sleep tonight?
You had better, I tell her, if you plan to go after your parents tomorrow. She considers that, and is clearly waffling, irritated by the fact that she knows I'm right. And just then, the lights begin flickering. We all kind of brace, like you do when you think you might be feeling an earthquake. Then the lights go out.
Oh, crap, says Garrett. Oh, crap, oh, crap, oh, crap.
It's okay, Alyssa says. This happened the other day. They'll come back on. You'll see.
But they don't. And the silence now is true silence. The hum of the refrigerator, the breath of the air conditioner, all gone. And the finality of that silence is so eerie, it's terrifying.
I feel a tight grip on my arm. It's Garrett. He was closer to me than he was to Alyssa. I'm the closest port in his storm.
Now we begin to hear voices, neighbors wondering what the hell is going on and what the hell they should do. What had seemed to be very surreal now has become vividly, luridly real. Our eyes begin to adjust to the dim afterglow of twilight lingering in the western windows. I know what I have to do. I need to go. But before I can finish, Garrett cuts me off.
No! You said you'd stay!
And although she doesn't say anything, I know Alyssa is just as freaked by the blackout as Garrett is. As I am.
I need to go, I say again, but only for a minute. I need to check on my parents, but I'll be right back.
And then I take a step closer to Alyssa. I can't quite see her face in the dim room, which is better for what I'm about to say.
I know you can take care of yourself. I know you don't need me here, but even so, it'll make the night a little bit easier.
Okay, says Alyssa. I just want to make sure. I mean, I don't want you to think... I know where she's going with this, and I save her the trouble. Alyssa, just because I'm offering to stay overnight in your house, don't get any ideas about me getting ideas. She sighs, relieved.
Thank you, Kelton, she says.
Then adds,
if it means anything, you've been officially lifted from creepy dude next door status.
You thought I was creepy?
Alyssa shrugs.
Kinda.
I consider that.
Yeah, I say.
I kind of am.
Then I leave, reminding them to lock the door behind me. My house is a beacon of light in the darkness. Off-grid. Totally self-sustainable. Inside, my mom's asleep on the couch, and my dad is still welding away in the garage. They have no clue that the power's down in the rest of the neighborhood. I don't engage them because there's nothing to say. I leave a note in my room that I'm spending the night at Alyssa's to help her out until her parents come home. My mother will like it, because it's something social that doesn't involve video games and guys who believe deodorant is optional. My father won't like it. but he also won't embarrass both of us by coming to retrieve me. I'll get an earful in the morning, but I'll deal with it then. I place the note on my comforter, then kneel down, reach an arm under my bed, and fish around until I find what I'm looking for. I slide out a black metal case and crack it open, revealing, in all its glory, my silver 45 caliber Ruger LCP pistol. I pull it out and load the magazine, trying not to be overwhelmed by its beauty and its power, the way its sleek silver barrel reflects light, contrasted by a black matte grip so dominant it absorbs any and all light that hits it. It's perfect in its dualistic nature, light and dark. Today, I feel like I'm something in between the two. And that's okay. It's what I need to be right now, if I'm going to be the first line of defense for Alyssa and Garrett. I tuck the handgun into my belt and hurry down the stairs and out the front door to head back to Alyssa's. But what I see as I come out our front door causes almost every joint to lock up. Although every other house is now blackened by nightfall, I swear I can make out figures in the street, faintly illuminated by a low-hanging moon. Most everyone in the neighborhood has stepped out of their home to marvel at our light, like moths entranced by the lick of a hot campfire flame. By having our own electricity supply, my family has made itself the unexpected envy of the neighborhood, and a target. So I stand, body trapped in the doorway, stuck between the threshold of what my life once was and what it will soon be, staring into the dark, 100 eyes glowing back in the night. And I'm scared to the bone, because right now, I can't tell if I'm looking into the eyes of sheep or wolves.
Day 4. Tuesday, June 7th. 8. Alyssa.
The next morning, I wake up to an obnoxious digitized symphony, the alarm on my phone, which, miraculously, held its charge overnight. It's 5:45 a.m., sunrise. At first, I couldn't sleep at all. Every sound was my parents coming home or someone breaking in. But neither of those things happened. Twice, I went downstairs to find Kelton doing the Boy Scout thing, reading a book by flashlight, while keeping watch for the non-existent bad guys he was so sure would be crashing through our windows to suck the moisture out of our veins. It all seemed so silly now in the light of day. Except for the fact that my parents still aren't home. No amount of happy sunshine is going to change that. Garrett, who had insisted he was okay sleeping in his room, had, at some point, surrendered all macho pretense and crawled in with me. Now he sleeps, and is in that blissful place where his only care in the world is what to feed Spider-Man and the various Pokemon who just came over for dinner, or whatever it is that 10-year-olds dream about. I don't wake him as I slip out of bed and head downstairs. I half hope that my parents came in while I was asleep and didn't want to wake us, but no such luck. In the living room is Kelton, snoring away on the sofa. So much for keeping watch. He was supposed to get me a few hours ago to relieve him, but he tried to soldier through the night on his own. That's when I see the gun. It's resting on the end table beside him like it's part of the decor. Lamp, family picture, pistol. He must have hidden it from me when he came back from his house, knowing I wouldn't approve. And I don't. It makes me consider demoting him back to creepy dude, but worse, because now it's creepy dude with a gun. I pick it up and right away find that it's much heavier than I had anticipated. And then I get a little freaked out realizing that I've never actually held a gun before. This thing ends lives. I put the pistol down, but slide it out of Kelton's immediate reach and shake him awake. The moment he's conscious, he bolts up. What? What happened? Is everything okay? Did I fall asleep? It is, and you did, I tell him. And now you're going to take the bullets out of that goddamn gun. He looks at me, then looks away. It has no bullets, he says. The magazine is in my pocket. I'm not an idiot. The jury's still out on that one, I tell him, then hold out my hand. Give. Reluctantly, he hands me the magazine of bullets, and although I don't want it in my pocket, I'd rather it be there than in his. Then I look at the gun again, furious that it's even here. I marched against these, I inform him. How could you bring one into my house? You marched against assault weapons, he says, far calmer about this than I am. I can respect that, but this is not that. This is a defensive weapon. We may need it to protect ourselves. He doesn't reach for it and override my objections with bravado. Instead, he waits for me to give him permission. The fact that he's deferring to me makes me feel better about it, but only a little. I reach out and push the pistol a few inches in his direction. You want to keep this for show? Fine, but you're not shooting anybody today. Understood, but a gun is worthless if you're not prepared to use it, he says. Probably something his father drilled into his head. I look out the window. The street's empty, but it's not even 6 a.m. I'm not expecting anyone to be out there. All I can think about now is my parents and all of the worst-case scenarios that probably didn't happen but still haunt me all the same. I try their phones again. Mom's goes straight to voicemail, but Dad's rings a few times first, which lets me know that at least it's on. Kelton makes a quick trip home to get tire sealant so we can take all three bikes, and when he returns, he's suited up in what looks like a duck hunting outfit, fully loaded with survival rope and a million pockets. I don't have the energy to make fun of him now, and I've come to trust that there's a reason for everything he does. We actually might need the rope and whatever other stuff he has hidden away in those pockets. Truth is, we need him. Plus, when it comes to water, he's the person to know. Without him, I'm not sure we'd have the rations to safely make the journey down to Laguna Beach and back. I had packed a backpack last night for the road. Beef jerky. The rest of our water, a kitchen knife. Although I'm sure Kelton has something much nastier than that hidden in his outfit. I don't ask. Anyway, I might as well have my own way to protect myself, so I don't feel I have to rely on Kelton's Krav Maga or whatever other lethal martial art he knows. I pet Kingston and give him a ration of water that I know is not enough but is all I can spare. Then, just before heading out of the house, I flip on a light switch to check the power again. No luck. I wonder how many other neighborhoods are without electricity right now. With the bikes now fully operational, we wheel them outside, manually pull down the garage door, and take to the streets. Looking around my neighborhood, I half expect it to be in ruins, but everything appears just as it always was, and I realize the wreckage is more internal. We push forward down our street, keeping the dawn to our backs. There's a path that runs down Aliso Creek Canyon that goes all the way to the beach, I tell Kelton, although I've never taken it all the way down, so I don't know how smooth it is. Bad idea, Kelton says. It's all wilderness and we'll be isolated. Targets for anyone who might jump us for our water. I want to tell him that he's being paranoid, but I know he might be right, and it pisses me off. The more we keep to civilization, the more likely that people will be civilized, he says, then adds, at least for now. I turn to Garrett as we leave our neighborhood and take to the bike lane of a major avenue. How are you doing? I ask him. Better than you, he brags. I ride my bike all the time, and you don't, so try to keep up. The fact that he's being a brat answers my question. He's in good spirits. It isn't long before we come to an overpass for the 5 freeway. As I look down, I can see a typical snarl of cars, but somehow this is different. This is bumper-to-bumper traffic like I've never seen before. Morning rush hour is usually all about heading north toward LA, but today, the traffic is at a horn-blaring standstill in both directions, as far as the eye can see, which eventually disappears into a thick crimson haze, swallowed whole by the sun cresting over Saddleback Mountain. Not our problem, I say to myself, a little creeped out. I try to focus straight ahead as we pedal across the overpass, but I can't pull myself away from the reality all around me. Where is everyone going? Garrett asks. Anywhere but here, Kelton answers. Yeah, says Garrett. Well, it looks like they're not going to get there. I don't think he realizes how deeply that truth resonates, and on every level. But Kelton does. When it's time to bail, there are non-traditional routes that most people don't know. They won't be gridlocked like the freeways. The fact that he said when, rather than if, stays with me far longer than I want it to. About 5 minutes later, Garrett pulls his favorite and most frustrating travel maneuver. I gotta go to the bathroom, he says. I tell him to pee in the bushes somewhere. But of course, it's not that kind of bathroom he's talking about. I imagine, considering the horrific state of our toilet, even with Kelton's waterless fix, Garrett has been holding it in rather than dealing with it. But there comes a point at which nature takes over, and always at the worst time. There's a familiar gas station with a convenience store up ahead, and although I'm sure its bathroom will be even worse than ours, I don't tell Garrett that. We pedal toward it. The three of us roll up to the store and step inside, taking in our surroundings. Like the rest of the world, the store is a slight aberration of normal. Bleak and dusty, the air is so thick it coats your throat. The AC's off, which we already knew since we hadn't hit a single functioning streetlight between home and here. Refrigerators that usually contain soda, energy drinks, and water are empty, as expected. But what I don't expect is how barren this place is, devoid of not just products, but even the hope of them. Only 1 in 10 items still remain on the shelves, one type of chips, one brand of gum. It reminds me of pictures I once saw in class of a destitute market in a war-torn country, where your only options were between canned beans or bread, and if you hesitated, you didn't get either. All the while, the grimness is mocked by 50s doo-wop music that echoes from an old battery-operated radio somewhere. At the far end of the store, the clerk sits behind the register. Someone I don't know. The thing is, I know this store. Mom and I would always stop here on the way home from soccer practice to get a Powerade and corn nuts, kind of a little ritual of ours. I thought I knew all the clerks who worked here, but not this one. He looks like the guy your parents warned you about, the one with a white windowless van rolling slowly past the park. He looks like Santa Claus after 2 tours in Vietnam. His shifty eyes are fixed on us, with one hand hidden below the counter. Garrett heads toward the bathroom, and the clerk shouts, "Gotta buy something to use the crapper!" And so, as Garrett closes the bathroom door behind him, Kelton and I move down an aisle to get something and to get out of the guy's line of sight. I settle on a bag of peanuts. As I approach the checkout, I get a closer look at the clerk. He looks worn, the skin around his eyes thick and heavy. I haven't seen you here before, I say, as he tallies up my items. He studies me coolly. I'm new. How long have the cars been like that on the freeway? I ask, changing the subject. He scratches his neck.
Middle of the night, I imagine. Brought a lot of customers here. Some were cool. Others thought they could just take whatever they wanted.
Why didn't you just call the cops? I ask. The man chuckles, but it comes out as a hiss.
Haven't you heard? You can't get through. 911 lines have been jammed since yesterday.
He grins, like it's funny. "That'll be $40, he says. At first, I think he's joking. But then I realize that, no, he's dead serious. "Free market economy," he says. "Supply and demand. And right now, there's a whole lot more demand than supply." He leans closer. "So like I said, that'll be $40. Kelton comes up beside me with a Clif Bar, having not heard any of my exchange with the clerk. That's when I notice the cash register. It's been smashed open, and I realize this guy isn't wearing the ugly blue and yellow shirt that the clerks here always wear. The more I try to comprehend what happened here, the more I don't want to know. Garrett comes out of the bathroom, and I grab the Clif Bar from Kelton's hand, throw it down on the counter, and before he has a chance to object, I grab Garrett's hand, knowing that it will startle him into submission, and I hurry all three of us out.
"Gotta pay for the goddamn bathroom!"
the man inside yells, but we are already gone. I hop on my bike and re-race off, but I keep in the lead, setting the pace, and the pace is fast. A few blocks away, I slow down enough for Garrett and Kelton to catch up with me. I stop and look back to make sure that the guy from the convenience store isn't chasing us.
"What was that all about?" Kelton asks.
I don't tell him. Not because I don't want to, but because the particulars don't matter anymore. "That gun of yours? It's in your backpack, right?"
"Yeah."
"And you know how to use it?"
"Hell yeah."
I reach into a side pocket of my own backpack and pull out the compact cartridge of bullets. The magazine, Kelton had called it. I look at it. Think hard about it. It represents everything that I hate about the world. But this isn't the same world it was yesterday. Finally, I hand him the magazine, then I start pedaling again, because I don't want to see him snapping it into the pistol.
Snapshot. Interstate, northbound, 6:30 a.m. When Charity first learned to drive back in the 60s, she was taught to leave one car length between you and the car ahead of you for every 10 miles per hour you're traveling. That way, you'll give yourself ample time to brake. But when no one's going anywhere, your bumpers all might as well be touching. Gridlock. Or maybe something worse, if that's even possible. At first, it's the typical rush hour stop and go. But on this particular Tuesday, things start to feel different right away. There is a thickness in the air that reads like claustrophobia. It's evident in the positioning of the cars, more tightly squeezed than ordinary traffic. And soon there's even a sixth lane that was once a shoulder that cars have started funneling into and stopping. Charity left her apartment just before 5 a.m., hoping to beat traffic on the way to Henderson, Nevada, where she planned to spend the worst of this crisis with her daughter and grandchildren. But it looks like she wasn't the only one with plans to get away. She looks to the other side of the highway, noticing the drivers going in the opposite direction seem to be in the same predicament. Perhaps even worse, since there are a few cars stuck facing the wrong way. Something she's never seen before. Clearly, the traffic got so bad, people turned around on the road and tried to go the other way, hoping that backtracking would actually cut their losses. Then again, this is probably the kind of elliptical logic that jammed up the highway in the first place. Charity takes in her surroundings. An impatient man in a Harley trying to work his way between traffic like threading a needle. A family in a minivan, a cable repair truck. She passes the time by thinking about who these people might be and what their stories are, where they're coming from and where they're going. Sure, the water crisis is bad, but not every one of these people could possibly believe it's so bad that they'd need to leave for greener pastures. Charity looks to an old black-and-white image of her and her late husband wedged into the dashboard. If he were still alive, she thinks to herself, he'd probably be kicking and screaming by now. For decades, the two of them owned a pawn shop, where Charity would handle the customers. She was always the cool-tempered one. Her parents had named her Charity, one of the seven virtues, and she had always tried to live up to that name, giving her full heart to whoever she encountered. Rare in the pawn business, but it was what it was. She added a ray of light in miserable circumstances. However, now, staring into the endless snarl of automobiles, she's starting to wish they had named her Patience. Another half hour, and still no movement. Not an inch. People start to get restless, standing on the roof like packs of meerkats, all trying to get a better view of the highway ahead. A man and his young son walk down the row past Charity. She rolls down her window. "Getting out for a stretch?" she asks. The father smiles weakly. "Gonna check things out up ahead, see if anyone knows what the holdup is." The fact that people are doing something active to help the situation makes her feel a little bit better. And things could be worse. In between lanes, kids now play tag, weaving in and out of the landlocked cars, while their parents play cards on the hoods. It makes her think of her own daughter, how she always worries when Charity makes the long drive to Nevada. At this rate, she might not get there till dark. Another 45 minutes. The sun beams down now. Any impatient honking has stopped. Most of the car's engines are off. There are people in cars around her who seem to have given up hope altogether, but are hanging tough in their vehicles. Some even huddle together by the side of the road or lie down in the shade between cars, as if going to sleep and then waking would magically make the situation disappear. Charity taps her hand on the dash, anxiety growing. The man and his son never return to their car. It will have to be towed and will add that much more pain to the process. Charity locks her doors and leans back, resting her eyes for a brief moment. 30 minutes later, her eyes snap open as she's awakened by the sound of screams ricocheting between cars, originating from God knows where. And then someone sprints past her window, and then someone else. And before she knows it, the scene is total chaos. Everyone abandons their cars and runs south, the complete opposite direction of traffic. What would compel every one of them to run in the opposite direction where they were headed? Charity steps out of her car to get a better view, walking north against the stampede, and finally sees what everyone is running from. A fire. Black smoke billows and swirls in the morning sky, and below it, maybe 50 yards ahead, is a single car that is caught on fire. It's a valid reason to flee, because if that car explodes, and if the explosion is large enough, it could set off a chain reaction of exploding cars up and down the freeway. But if Charity has learned anything in all her years, it's to keep a calm head, especially in the face of utter chaos. She is a child of the 60s. Following the pack blindly has never been her ethos. Instead, Charity decides to ask herself the contrarian questions of the world, because unique questions will always yield unique answers. She marches forward against the current, even as the mob grows, cascading in an avalanche of panic that picks up everyone else in its path, including those who don't even know why they're running. Charity moves toward the fire, the hysteria heightening. People are trampled, bruised, bloodied. But where everyone else sees disaster, Charity finds opportunity. Back when she and her husband had the pawn shop, Charity learned a thing or two about junk. It was always about looking closer, finding the treasure in the trash, identifying the true diamonds that were worth more than the fake gold ring that held them. She searches the dozens of cars for anything that could help her put the fire out. What kind of car would have a fire extinguisher? She thinks to herself. She goes to the TV cable truck and opens up the back double doors, but with no luck. Just boxes of wires and junk. And then, the situation escalates even further with the sound of a blast. The car that's on fire up ahead has exploded, blowing off the hood and setting fire to a couch in the bed of a nearby pickup truck. This is rapidly going from bad to worse. Charity scans the rows of cars one final time and sees an electrician's van, with the electrician long gone. She quickly pops the back doors open and bingo, a fire extinguisher right there strapped to the door. So Charity marches toward the blaze, extinguisher in hand, a fire in her eyes hotter than any earthly inferno. Nine. Alyssa.
We ride down Laguna Canyon Road,
a main street that we've always taken to get to the beach. I try to transport myself back to one of the times that I enjoyed the ride, but it's just not the same. The arid wind cuts at my face. The burn in my legs feels less like exercise and more like a dreadful punishment. Passing neighborhoods on a major main street does allow me to peer in from a safe distance, and I'm noticing that a few areas still have electricity, which is somewhat comforting to see. It makes me think that they're working on solving these problems. Maybe cell phone towers are out because they have no power. I try to convince myself that's the reason why I get nothing every time I try to call my parents. "You should stop calling," Kelton tells me. "You're draining your battery, and you might need your phone later." "Maybe it's just really crowded there," Garrett says, doing his own rationalizations. "Like when people were camped out for days for that last Star Wars movie." "But would Mom and Dad camp out at the beach waiting for water when they knew that Garrett and I were home waiting for them?" As much as I want the answer to be something simple that we'll all be able to laugh about later, the longer we don't hear from them, the harder it is for me to paint a rosy picture. We arrive mid-morning at Laguna Beach, where the marine layer still creates an overcast haze, keeping the shoreline mercifully cool. I can smell the ocean and feel the salt air making my clothes cling to my skin. Waves thunder in the distance, and although the ocean's cadence has always been comforting to me, the silence that lingers in between each crashing wave now strikes me as odd. Still, I push forward on my bike, flying down the last stretch of road which dead-ends into the Pacific Coast Highway and the beach just beyond. I don't feel the blisters on my hands anymore or the ache in my legs. I have to see that beach. I have to know that my parents are there and that they're okay. But once I'm across PCH at the edge of the boardwalk, I hit my brakes hard and stop dead in my tracks. Because before me isn't a beach populated by families retrieving water rations, but a vast, sandy wasteland. It's virtually deserted, with just a few random people who seem to meander aimlessly. Farther out, toward the water's edge, are machines hitched to the backs of trucks, maybe half a dozen of them spread out along the beach, but they're not producing water. They're not doing anything. In fact, one of them is spewing black smoke, and another one is lying on its side. I drop my bike and step down from the boardwalk to the sand, with Garrett and Kelton close behind. My eyes dart around, searching for my parents, desperate for even the slightest sign of them. And then Garrett says, "Alyssa, do you hear that?" I do. It's a sound almost musical and eerily electronic that lingers just beneath the sound of the waves. I walk across the sand, and the sound gets louder until I realize it's not just one sound, but many, all blending together. And all at once, I realize what it is. Cell phones. The ringtones of cell phones. There are dozens of them lying in the sand around us, creating an eerie 8-bit symphony, the lost calls of 1,000 souls. None of us knows how to react. We just watch the phones as they vibrate and ring, trying to overcome our shock. And suddenly, I realized that until just a short time ago, I was on the other end of one of those lines, calling nonstop, desperately hoping that someone would answer. I see one vibrating halfway out of the sand, and I dare myself to grab it. I hold it in my hand, and after one more ring, I answer, pressing the sandy iPhone to my ear. "Hello?" comes the voice of a child on the other end of the line. "Mom?" He couldn't be any older than Garrett. I try to choose my words carefully. "This isn't your mother," I tell him. "Where's my mom?" begs the child. "Who is this? Why do you have her phone?" I pause, not sure what I can say to calm him. I'm at the beach, I tell him. Your mom dropped her phone at the beach. She went there to get water. I don't think there's any water here, I tell him. Can you tell that to an adult? Please, tell that to an adult. Where's my mom? The kid cries. I try to formulate the best response I can, but it's like I've lost my ability to put together coherent thoughts. I have no answer for him any more than I have an answer for myself. I'm sorry, I tell him. Then I hang up and drop the phone in the sand, and when it rings again, I bury it. I bury it deep enough so at least there's one phone I can't hear ringing anymore. What happened here? Asks Kelton. And bit by bit, the clues emerge. They are in plain sight around us, right there in the sand. It's as if a tornado had passed through, depositing debris everywhere, debris that looms like a shadow of terrible events I can't even begin to imagine. Plastic tables and chairs are overthrown, trash all around, being picked at by seagulls. A single, abandoned shoe, which somehow seems creepiest of all. And the sand is peppered with black aluminum cans, dozens of them. I'm hit with a wave of the most awful stench, like bleach mixed with snot. It stings the inside of my nostrils, so I hold my nose, but it hardly helps. Kelton reaches down and picks up one of the cans, holding it at a safe distance. These are tear gas canisters, Kelton says. There must have been a riot squad here. And then there are the machines. We approach the closest one. I can see that it's torn to shreds. All of them are. This one's stainless steel facade has been peeled back, exposing its innards as if it were decomposing from the inside out. Tubes and wiring herniate from the opening, all leading to a series of dials and gauges connected to three ruptured vats, and behind it, a series of arrested pistons. Could people have done this? Could we have fought each other over these life-saving machines, reducing them to scrap metal? Could we be so desperate for drinkable water that we're willing to destroy the very machines that could create it, just to get that first sip? And if so, were Mom and Dad among them? Now I can see that at each ruined desalination machine stands a police officer in riot gear with an automatic rifle, warning people to keep away, as if there's still something to protect. What happened here? I ask the one closest to us, keeping a safe distance.
You need to leave the beach, miss. Go home. Wait there for further instructions.
What happened to the people who were here? I demand. Were they sent somewhere else? A different beach?
It isn't safe to be here, he tells me. You need to go home.
I back away, right into Garrett, whose eyes have teared up, and it has nothing to do with the tear gas.
Make him tell you where they went, Garrett says, as if he can order me to make demands of an armed officer.
Guys? I look over to Kelton, who's standing closer to the water's edge. I follow his gaze to the spiteful ocean and direct all of my hate toward it. I can't stand the way each crashing wave of undrinkable water mocks us.
What is that? Asks Kelton.
He points to something that's floating, moving forward and backward with the rolling surf. A dark outline in the rolling water, visible for only moments between waves.
Is that, Kelton squints, is that a body?
And I know that whatever it is, I've had enough. It's more than not wanting to know. I don't even want to know the depth of the things I don't want to know. I grab Garrett and pull him away and call to Kelton. Kelton, we're leaving. Because maybe I can't order a crowd control officer, but I sure as hell can order Kelton, especially when it's for his own good. I will not think about my parents now,
because if I do, I will crumble. Getting home will be an uphill ride in more ways than one, and that has to be the focus of all my mental energy right now. Getting us home. We get to our bikes back at the boardwalk. We have to do something, Garrett insists. We can't just leave. And I turn on Garrett with a fury I didn't even know I had. Garrett, if you don't shut your mouth right now, I'm gonna shut it for you. And that just brings forth a deluge of tears from him. But I can't cry. I have to hold it together, and I'm sorry, so sorry that I took my frustration out on him. I take him into my arms and hold him. I let him sob. I don't say anything. I just let him sob, because I know that's what he needs. And he knows I didn't mean it. He knows because of how tight I'm holding him. And I won't let go until he's ready for me to. Alyssa, we should go, says Kelton, looking even more freaked out by the unidentified floating object than I am. Garrett pulls away from me gently. Let's just go, he says, tired, defeated. The plan is to travel back the way we came, but even before we get started, something across the street grips my attention, the sound of shouting voices. It's a trio of kids our age, or maybe a year or two older. They're in front of the abandoned Laguna movie theater. They've formed a circle, playing some sort of game, as if this were a time for fun and games. I turn to ride toward them, hoping that maybe they can give us some information about what went down here. But as soon as I come around a parked car, I can see the truth of the situation. They aren't playing. They're pushing around an older man, who's maybe in his 60s. It's 3-on-1, and he's helpless to defend himself. Without thinking it through, I jump off my bike, my hands curled into fists, and I'm marching toward them. Alyssa, wait, Kelton calls, but I'm already committed. Hey, I yell, what do you think you're doing? The tallest of the kids turns to me. He has tousled, bleached blonde hair and glacial blue eyes. He's rough-hewn like a jock, but his multiple piercings tell me he's not. Mind your own business, he says. The man they're pushing around stumbles to the ground, and the kid kicks him. He actually kicks him. Leave him alone, I yell, or I'm getting those officers from the beach. They won't care, says one of the other kids. They won't even leave their posts. You're monsters, I yell, and the blue-eyed kid goes feral on me. Monsters! We're monsters? You don't know me. I know all I need to know. You're beating on some poor defenseless man. Do you know what this asshole did? Yells the blue-eyed kid. We saw him hide a bottle of water in his car, and he won't share a drop of it. So, I counter, it's his water. You have no right. We have every right. Only now do I see how dry his lips are. Not just dry, but parched and chapped to the point of bleeding. None of these kids look right. Their skin is thin and almost leprous gray. The corners of their mouths are white with dried spit, and the look in their eyes is almost rabid. The tall kid turns and kicks the man again. Give us your goddamn keys! Please, pleads the man. I need that water. I need it for my family. So do I, asshole. You think because you drive a freaking BMW, your lives mean more? Before he can kick the man again, I hurl myself into the middle. His foot connects with my calf. It'll give me a Charlie horse, but at least it may have saved this guy from getting a broken rib. You don't have to give them anything, I tell the man, but he's too frightened to fight them anymore. He fumbles in his pocket and holds the keys out to the blue-eyed kid. But before the kid can snatch them out of his hands, I do instead, and hold them tight in my fist. You're not getting these, I tell the kid. The man, no longer the focus of their fury, scrambles away, not caring about his BMW or his water. He just wants to get out of this alive. And now I realize that I'm the one who might not. The blonde kid grabs me. He has a neck tattoo that seems to practically throb with his fury. It's a biohazard symbol. "Mess her up, Dalton," says one of the other boys.
"Hey, maybe she's got water too," says the third.
The blonde kid, Dalton, tries to wrench the keys from my hand, but I won't let go of them. I refuse to allow this sorry excuse for a human being to have them. His unnerving blue eyes dart back and forth across my face, and his cracked lips peel into a truly terrible grin, deranged and dangerous. "You're sweating," he says, "which means you've been drinking water." And then the grin vanishes. "Where is it?"
"Get away from my sister!" I hear Garrett yell.
He runs toward us, but one of the other kids grabs him. I try to pull out of Dalton's grip, but I can't get free, no matter how hard I try.
"Where's your water?" he demands.
And then something comes over me, my own animal nature.
"Right here," I tell him, and I spit in his face.
It doesn't faze him at all, and I'm suddenly hit with this strange sensation, like there's an emergency alarm echoing in my head, and my brain is helpless to identify its source. But as this boy wipes the spittle from his cheek with his free hand, the awful feeling becomes identifiable. It's a horror that makes me sick to my stomach. I know what he's about to do before he does it. He looks at his fingers, glistening with my spittle, and he licks it off. I try to struggle free, but Dalton pushes me hard against the wall and locks eyes with me.
"Do it again,"
he demands. And when I don't, he presses his body against me. I can't move.
"Do it, or I swear I'll suck it right out of you."
And he moves his terrible dry mouth toward mine. Then, from a few yards away, comes a voice of salvation.
"Let her go, or I'll blow your goddamn brains out."
Ten. Kelton.
I didn't want to have to pull out my gun, but the second that creep got too close to Alyssa, it's like some protective instinct kicked in. Now, my Ruger is pointed right at his head. I'm supposed to point it at his chest, but at this angle, all I have is his back, and a bullet in the back could go straight through him and into Alyssa. But he's taller. A headshot will miss Alyssa. The instant the other two creeps see my Ruger, they drop Garrett and bolt. But the tall blonde kid still grips Alyssa. I said, "Let her go!" My hand trembles. I reach up my other hand into a two-handed grip, but it doesn't help. Now he turns to see the gun, and Alyssa uses the moment to break free, instantly distancing herself and going straight to Garrett to protect him. The creep just stands there, looking at me, as if he doesn't care if I pull the trigger, as if he's already resigned himself to death. I stare him straight in those ice-blue eyes, and then focus back on my aim. Now my hands aren't just trembling, they're shaking, violently. I try to stop them, but it's like my brain can't seem to send the signal that far down my arms, like I'm disconnected from my own body. And now, I'm struck with a crippling wave of panic that starts in my chest and pulls like a lethal gravity, collapsing my lungs until I've imploded so deep within myself I can't breathe. I can barely gasp. "He'll do it!" Alyssa screams. The sound reverberates and echoes. "You better run like your friends!" "No," he says. "Just, no." And then, he takes a step toward me. Or does he? I can barely tell because now my vision is going spotty, as my brain misfires, shutting down piston by piston.
"Do it, Kelton! Do it!" Garrett yells.
But I can't. With all the training,
With everything I've been taught about self-defense and the wielding of weapons, something inside me blows a critical fuse. I can't bring myself to pull that trigger. And the kid knows it. He lurches forward, knocking me back, and the gun flies out of my hands. I can't let him get it. He'll kill all of us. He's that crazy. I know he is. The weapon lands in the trash-filled gutter. We both scramble for it. I don't know which one of us is more desperate to get it. And when I get to where I thought I saw it land, it's not there. Instead, there's a girl standing there, as if she appeared out of nowhere. A girl I've never seen before. And she's holding my gun, pointed directly at me. She cocks it, loading a bullet into the chamber with expert precision. And I realize that even if I had pulled that trigger, nothing would have happened, because I never even took the safety off. She smiles, almost seductively, and it's in this moment I realize that the gun isn't pointed at me at all. She has it trained on the ice-eyed creep who's right behind me. She brushes me out of the way with a deranged sort of confidence and puts the muzzle of the gun to the kid's forehead. I look to Alyssa, who, just like me, is shocked by the appearance of this mysterious girl and terrified by what her intentions might be. I struggle to force my anxiety attack away. The kid winces as she presses the gun harder against his forehead, a lot more terrified of her than he was of me. He stammers excuses, anything to buy time. It's them, not me. They have the water. Why me? Why you? She says, oddly pensive. I guess I don't really like your face. Bet it was once pretty, though. Pretty beach boy. I got dumped